Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm spiffy.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First, stop paying controversies and non-troversies. South Park is back. They've been going after the Trump administration and his hangers-on, hammer and tongs. Some backstory here. As we discussed a couple of weeks back, lots of folks were in a tizzy because CBS canceled The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. CBS said it was because the show lost a lot of money, and I have no doubt that it does lose a lot of money. Apparently, it cost $100 million a year, and nobody watches late night TV anymore. Liberal said it was because he criticized Donald Trump, and let's be honest, if you're losing money and a political headache, it's not a good position to be in. I still think it was all about the money. All the more so given what the boys at South Park have been up to in these first two episodes since signing a massive $1.5 billion with a B dollar deal with Paramount Plus, securing streaming rights for that service over the next 5 years or so, and also getting, you know, Trey Parker and Matt Stone a big fat paycheck to produce 10 new episodes a year. You work 10 weeks a year. $300 million, that's a good deal. You take it. You take that every time. In the season premiere, Donald Trump was depicted in the same style and with the same voice that they used to animate Saddam Hussein, down to Trump sleeping with Satan and having a micro penis. The episode featured Trump threatening to sue anyone who disagreed with him or spoke up against him, showed 60 Minutes acting in a very cowardly fashion, rebranded the formerly woke character PC Principal as Power Christian Principal, and then had him doing, he was like bringing Jesus into the school and he was doing the right wing cancellation bit. And then it closed the whole thing with a PSA that showed Trump nude, crawling through the desert. And then again, his little tiny micro penis with googly eyes on it said a thing at the end. In the second episode, which aired last week, longtime guidance counselor Mr. Mackey was fired. He had to join ICE, I-C-E, to make ends meet, and winds up winning the heart of Christy Noem, who spends most of the episode shooting dogs and raiding heaven to find illegal immigrants to send back to Mexico. That's a thing that happens in the episode. The main plot, by the way, involved Cartman and Clyde stealing Charlie Kirk's Debate Me Bro podcast style that wound up with them being described as master debaters. It's a silly joke. It's a very childish joke, but it was very funny to me. I laughed and laughed at that. If the first episode was a solid 10 out of 10, maybe a 9 out of 10, very good. I'd say the second one a little closer to a 6 out of 10. I think they went to the face-melting dog shooting gags one or three too many times. But you know, whatever. I like the Debate Me Bro podcast bit much more. I thought that was much funnier. Anyway, it's still pretty funny, and it's very strong evidence that Paramount / CBS / Viacom / Skydance / whoever is actually in charge over there of what's going on right now is happy to let their people poke the bear so long as the pokers are making money off that bear. I don't really want to get into the Paramount of it all. We hashed that out a couple weeks ago. I don't really want to do that. Instead, I want to focus on the response, because there are two ways to respond to South Park making fun of you. The first is to be like, oh, you guys got me. That was hilarious. And that is the tack that Charlie Kirk and J.D. Vance, as much as it pains to say me, pains me to say it, they took that tack. And it's the right way to go, right? You roll with it. You take it as a badge of honor. It neuters the mockery. The other way to respond is to whine like a small child about the unfairness of it all. I have two small children. This is what they sound like. You've seen this response from a number of right-wing influencers on Twitter who are pulling, who are just going on and on. They're just puling. They're whining about the fact that the show wasn't mean enough to Biden. They didn't do any jokes about Biden. Not true, by the way. They did jokes about Biden, but the show also, like, wasn't really on the air for almost that whole 4-year stretch. Weird kind of break in their programming due to various rights issues. Like the Autism Capital dude said it was mean-spirited to tell the White House to eat a bag of dicks. And then Christy Noem herself is out there. She's whining about the sexism making fun of her dopey photo shoots while trying to reclaim the initiative by putting those, you know, those laser red eyeball things on pictures. She did that with the South Park caricature making fun of her. And she thinks that that's like a way to turn it around. Sorry, you already lost this one. You whined first, you lose. And that said, on the flip side of things, I'm a both sides it. I do think progressives and liberals and anti-Trump people of all varieties, which I am, even if I'm not a progressive or a liberal, I think you have to understand how silly you look if you stomp your feet and say, don't you know you're being made fun of, when Kirk and Vance and that sort of guy rolls with it, right? You don't actually need other people to be publicly sad or mad when they're being made fun of. We have won. We've won the culture war here. They're being mocked. Don't school marm it up by demanding that the offended act outraged so you can watch them be offended. It's lame. One thing I think is important to understand about this season is that the South Park guys have always been more interested in opposing the side that has cultural rather than political power. They're not a partisan outlet. They're not a partisan comedy machine. They are interested in the cultural side of things, not the political side of things. And that's why they introduced PC principle during the so-called, you know, peak woke era, right? Back in 2014, 15, 16, right? They've now rebranded him Howard Christian principle, because the side with the power to get people fired and to get people canceled has flipped hard and they're rolling with it. Peter, what do you make of the new season of South Park?
Well, I should say I am not a regular South Park watcher because I don't watch TV comedy, guys. We've talked about this weird rule that I have. It's not a rule, but it's like I don't really watch things that are supposed to be funny on television that are series. It's just an odd tick that I have. But I want to take kind of an issue, not exactly with your description of them, because yes, they're not partisan in the sense of being Democrat or Republican. And I don't think they, you know, the show isn't like there to kind of boost any one political party or another. And you're totally right that they go after whoever is in power. But I would say that the South Park guys are in spirit actually just quite libertarian. And part of being a libertarian is going after whoever is in power at the moment. And this wins you some friends sometimes when you're on the side that when people are like, hey, you're going after that guy and we don't like him either. And it also wins you enemies when people are like, hey, you're going after my guy. This is like the whole thing that this is what it's like to work in a libertarian magazine. And in fact, South Park guys, Trey Parker and Matt Stone, have done events with Reason, not recently, but years in the past. We put South Park on the cover, I don't know, sometime in the mid late aughts, I think 2007 or so. And so there is like a real libertarian spirit to what they're doing. And it is a sort of anarchic, comedic, chaotic libertarian spirit that is just like, hey, whoever it is who has taken power in the cultural political realm, we are going to take them down a peg. And it's a great kind of like, this is something that we talk about at Reason Magazine actually pretty frequently, is like, let me back up just a little bit. Sometimes you see sort of instances in which someone is no longer in power, but the person who is in power is maybe doing something that even their own side is somewhat uncomfortable with. So what does their own side end up doing in their booster, the people who nominally would be boosting them in the media? They end up just sort of continuing to talk about how the side that is out of power now, oh, they're so bad. They're so right. There's a bunch of losers. They're awful. Maybe this is true in some cases, but they end up ignoring their own side and its faults. And I see, think you see this amongst Republicans and Democrats, the right and the left. But like what libertarians at their best, I think, do is just say, well, whoever's in power, that's who we're going after today. And South Park does the same thing. And I sort of think of them as kindred spirits in a way. And in fact, like on another podcast, made the argument recently that I don't know if they call themselves libertarians, and I'm not going to put that word in their mouth or anything like that, but like their show is the most important libertarian cultural product of my lifetime. I think more even certainly that has come out in my lifetime. And to think of anything with a kind of comparable influence, you've got to go to like Robert Heinlein novels, you know, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress and that sort of thing, or Ayn Rand, right? Stuff that's much, much older than I am, right? Which whatever you, I'm not making an argument for Ayn Rand. I'm simply saying major cultural influence. Like we can have the Ayn Rand argument on a different episode, but
no, I understand that they do the libertarian thing where they like don't actually vote for anybody and then say all the sides are bad. And that's, you know, it's kind of like taking a stance, I guess. But it's neither here nor there. Like you're not really disagreeing with the point I make, which is that they essentially just go after whoever is out of power.
Yeah, that's
like
right.
that's not strictly speaking a libertarian point of view. It's really more of a contrarian thing. It's, you know, we're doing a different.
Well, I would take you back to one of their most famous and enduring episodes and metaphors, which is the douche versus the turd as like the electoral choice in whatever stupid local race that they were, you know, covering. And this is like 20 years ago. And, you know, the editor of Reason Magazine, my boss and friend, Catherine Mangu Ward, will like say that continues to be all these years later, her go-to metaphor for like explaining her view of politics.
Yeah, that was I think it was 2004. That was Bush versus Kerry. Alyssa, what do you make of the response to what is going on here? Because I do think it's interesting. I think there's, In the like online life in which we live, there is a value to being able to kind of roll with being made fun of that is more effective than getting mad and angry about it, right? Like, isn't that basically?
And I think it's interesting that Christine Noem's response to this is very much out of a sort of feminist critique of media, of, you know, maybe 5 or 6 or 7 years ago. And I mean, I've eaten, you know, I have even written things, not quite in the vein of like, you're never allowed to make fun of a woman for her looks or whatever, but in it, you know, arguing that there's something kind of unseemly about, you know, being ugly about people who, you know, you would react very differently if the person being criticized was kind of on their team. Written this about, you know, like Lauren Boebert in particular, in ways that people got very angry at me about online. I find all of this kind of interesting to watch for two reasons. First, I'm really sort of not a South Park person, like aesthetically, temperamentally. I have never been super into the like, oh, we're so naughty and we're getting away with it, school of humor. I do find the way that it works here interesting, especially in contrast to Colbert. Because I think, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, but part of what I find, you know, sort of interesting about the way South Park is kind of taking on the administration is that it is not superior, right? Like, this is not about like the Trump administration is ridiculous, but like we would never go so far, right? It's the South Park guys don't seem to like really claim to be superior to anyone. And in fact, like, it's almost a sort of comedic stylings of anti-superiority.
I think what you're getting at here, if I can put words in your mouth
of
for
course,
a second,
yeah,
is that they're willing to get in the muck in a way that,
yeah,
I think lots of the left, you know, Colbert always frames his critiques as this guy's an idiot or this guy's gauche or this guy's a monster and we have to be afraid of him. Right. And I think the South Park guys are very much like, this guy sucks. He sucks. And this is, we're happy to show the ways in which he sucks in ways that will like hurt his feelings.
Yes. This is very much not like, you know, when they go low, we go high. This is like, you know, when they go low, we descend like all the way, you know, into the mud and come up sort of gleefully like Pigpen. And again, it's not sort of a style of comedy that I resonate to personally, but the combination of sort of this and The Naked Gun last week have me thinking about the sort of leveling powers of embracing stupidity, if that makes any sense.
Totally.
Like, and I think that there's something very interesting about the idea that like South Park is worth paying what, $1.2 billion for?
1.5.
1.5, Lord.
There were reports that where it was like it was a billion and maybe more up to 1.5. It's somewhat unclear exactly how the numbers on that deal work.
Right. But like I think it's interesting that sort of refusal to be superior is, and also, I mean, I have to imagine, like, how much do we think South Park costs to produce, right?
Very little.
It's very cheap. Yeah. It has to have become more expensive because they've kept a bunch of their staff over the years. But in the aughts, there was a report that each episode was only about $250,000, and they still produce all of their episodes in, as far as I know, in a basically a 7-day cycle. And yeah, sure, you can pay people a lot for a day rate, but just the compressed schedule inherently means it's going to be relatively inexpensive, especially since, if I understand correctly, they do this with a staff of fewer than 100. So, you know, like it used to be 70. It used to be a 70 person staff. Maybe it's grown a little bit now that they're bigger and they have a lot more money.
But so if it's less than half of Colbert's, of like the staff of The Late Show, and it's those people are being paid for fewer days. And yeah, I mean, it's got to be tremendously cheaper. The profit margins have to exist, whereas Late Show appeared to be losing money. But I do think that, you know, that distinction between like humor about being superior to Trump, whereas humor would be like, you're absurd, and I know because I'm absurd and puerile too. I think that's instructive, even if I don't quite know how other comedians or even sort of political strategists could actually operationalize that.
I think looking at South Park as a tool to defeat Trump is the wrong way to do it. It is the man is impervious to just about anything else.
Yes.
But I do think that it is more compelling to me to treat him as a clown-ish figure of fun than it is to treat him as a world conquering threat. Because I think the latter kind of plays into his own conception of himself as the man in charge, the deal maker. You should be afraid of me because I'll, yeah. And, I don't know. I know, look, you're going to get people yelling at me. Of course he is a danger. He is doing all these bad things. And yes, he is. Yes, he is. But also like calling him that is not an effective way of neutering him in the eyes of the folks who actually like most need to be peeled away from Donald Trump. And this is where I will get into the politics of it, because I do think that there is a contingent of like the Joe Rogan style podcast debate me bros who have gravitated toward Trump because he is the opposite of everything that they hated. He's the anti-cancel culture guy, whatever. And now they could be made to realize that he is just as bad from the other side as anything that they had to deal with in the Biden and Obama years.
He's like he's another weird deranged grandpa.
I don't know. Peter, do you think that analysis there is wrong? Am I barking up the wrong tree there?
I think that the South Park approach is, again, I think you're basically correct. You are. It is not going to win political victories in the like electoral box office, right? Like it's not going to flip the House or anything like that. At the same time, it probably stands a better chance of reaching whoever is persuadable, who is in the broader Trump coalition, probably not the most hardcore Trump supporters, but people are sort of at the edges of the Trump coalition who might be persuadable are probably going to be more likely to be persuaded, or maybe not persuaded, but moved. Like, persuaded is the wrong word, right? This is not advocacy.
Yeah.
Moved a little bit from their, right? Like it's gonna get to them. They might appreciate this in a way that they're not going to appreciate, I don't know, an MSNBC monologue or a Colbert joke.
Right. And this is, I think, why I'm sorry to keep bringing it back to this, but I do think it's the most important part. This is, I think, why the kind of right wing influencer set is so annoyed by what is happening here, because people they like and respect are showing Trump to be lame and uncool. And that is more devastating for them than just about anything else, right? Like it's this idea of total cultural victory. Like we have the power and the momentum, and to show him to be a ridiculous, clownish figure, obsessed with his own image and constantly threatening people and just as much of a cry bully as everything that they, you know, kind of fought against is, I think, damaging on some level. But I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe none of this matters.
It's entirely possible. Nothing matters, Sonny.
Nothing. LOL, nothing matters. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that LOL, nothing matters? Peter.
I mean, nothing has ever mattered, but South Park might matter. I don't know whether that's a controversy or a non-controversy. It's a non-controversy that South Park is making fun of the president. It's a little bit of a controversy that these, I don't know what to call them, the MAGA supporter types, that like they don't understand that they make themselves and their guy look worse by reacting like babies.
Alyssa.
I guess it's.
I don't know what the question is here. I honestly don't know. I don't know. It doesn't matter. Sum up your thoughts.
Your failure to frame a question is controversial.
Okay. It's a controversy. South Park should make fun of Donald Trump. And it's a controversy that people are whining about South Park making fun of Donald Trump, because that's what people always do when their guy gets made fun of. They whine. Bunch of whiners out there. Stop whining. Fucking babies. All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Thursday for a bonus episode in which we're going to discuss whether or not, quote, Hollywood is hot, horny, and white again, end quote, according to an op-ed in the New York Times by Sharon Waxman. Until then, on to the main event. Weapons, directed by Zach Cregger of Barbarian fame. Weapons has been described as the Magnolia of Horror, a movie weaving together several different points of view before they all kind of collide at the end of the film in a magnificent car crash of expectations and brutality and funniness. So there's a lot of comedy in this movie. Since I have to repeat this once every 3 weeks, we are taping this show after the film's debut because we would like to discuss the things that happened in the movie. And as such, there will be spoilers. You should watch this movie without being spoiled. So stop listening if you haven't watched it yet and go watch the movie. Go see it tonight and then listen to this. But do not complain to me about spoilers. Do not listen to a podcast about a movie if you're worried about spoilers. Log off now. I don't know if you can tell. Somebody brought this up to me again. It drives me crazy. Don't listen to a podcast about a movie if you don't want to hear spoilers for the movie. All right.
Wait, were people mad about Naked Gun spoilers?
No, it was something else.
Fish hands?
Different movie. Anyway, let's talk about Weapons. In a voiceover prologue, we learn that one night at precisely 2:17 a.m., every kid in a third grade class left their houses, ran away, and, quote, they never came back. The movie picks up properly 1 month later, and from there we get a series of vignettes looking at how the town and its people dealt with the tragedy. There's the teacher, Justine Gandy, who is played by Julia Garner, who sees all of the kids in her class but one go missing. The town turns on her, she turns to drink, and then she tries to figure out where they went. Grieving father Archer, who's played by Josh Brolin, is seeing his life fall apart. He's sleeping in his kid's room. He's messing up his business orders, et cetera, et cetera. And he, too, wants to solve the case, and he does so in a kind of aggressively creepy manner. There's a cop who's played by Alden Ehrenreich. There's a junkie played by Austin Abrams. There's the school principal played by Benedict Wong. And then finally, there's Alex, the one little boy from Miss Gandy's class who did not disappear. It is with him that we will learn the truth. And more on him in a moment. The Magnolia comparison is understandable as shorthand, but not quite correct, right? This is really more like a Pulp Fiction or a Reservoir Dogs in the sense that we spend time with these characters essentially seeing the story from their point of view while other characters pop in occasionally until it kind of they collide and wrap up at the end. And it is the perfect way to tell this story about a community dealing with tragedy and how that tragedy affects everyone differently, from alcoholism to depressive despondency to obsession. The aftermath of a tragedy is multivariate and often terrifyingly personal. The nature of the tragedy here is up for some debate, right? In the sense that I've seen folks insist that it's a very obviously and only a metaphor for school shootings, right? A whole class of kids disappears. This is the aftermath. But the beauty of Weapons is that it allows for many interpretations. After a decade of elevated horror movies that feel a little like op-eds, it's nice to have something a little more malleable, a little more flexible. For instance, at one point, just to explain kind of where this is coming from, at one point, Josh Brolin's character sees an AR-15 rifle floating monstrously, a giant one, floating above his house with the time 2:17 flashing on it, like it's an alarm clock where the power went out on. Obviously, this means it's about school shootings, right? Oh, maybe. Also, it could be a premonition of the tool he needs to take out the grooming gang that has set up shop in his nice little neighborhood. Because this is kind of what happens in the movie. And now we're going to go back to the Alex segment of things, right? His dying aunt has moved into the house. She's a witch. She puts the kids under a spell and they all run to Alex's basement so she can steal their essence. And here we see the one indisputable thematic through line of the film, which is the failure of older generations to aid and protect younger generations. And I mean, this is literally a movie about a boomer who sucks the life out of the younger generations to extend her own for a few measly months, right? If you can't feel echoes of that in all the stories we have about the elderly folks squandering their kids' inheritance to go on the cruises around the world for years, or living in their massive homes as empty nesters refusing to do anything to shore up Social Security or Medicare for generations to come, I don't know what to tell you. That is like the one actual definite thematic thing about this movie. One last thing I will note is that Weapons is tremendously funny. I haven't really gotten into this, but it's the sort of movie that makes you laugh out loud at the sheer audacity of what you're seeing on the big screen. Like Barbarian, which is another movie that has fairly big tonal swings that Zach Cregger also wrote and directed. Weapons is full of characters shouting, "What the fuck?" And if you're not thinking, "What the fuck?" at some point in this film yourself, I don't know what to tell you. Again, the form is function here. The fact that these things are all happening to people in separate spaces, apart from everyone else, leads to even more confusion and atomization. Atomization! That's the key here. In tragedy, we must come together. And yet so often we fall apart. Alyssa, what did you make of Weapons?
So as I said to you guys, I mean, my non-fondness for horror is sort of a matter of record for this podcast. And I have personal reasons to find this one sort of particularly disturbing. But I quite liked it and was glad that I saw it for the podcast. I think there were two things that really struck me about the movie's ending that I think underscore its ambiguity in really interesting ways. And people have talked about this as sort of a metaphor for school shootings, but I haven't seen anyone really talk about what that means for how we're supposed to see Alex in the movie, right? Because one of the things that is interesting about the conclusion is that we learn that Alex is on some level complicit in what happens to his classmates. He is... And basically what happens is he has been trapped in this house with his aunt. It's not, I mean, you sort of wonder at some point if Gladys is actually related to him or if this is all sort of witchery, but he is trapped in the house with an older adult who has shown him that she can do unbelievably awful things to his parents, including, she tells him at one point, like, "I can make them eat each other." And, you know, he is keeping them alive by feeding them soup. And she basically tells Alex that she might go away and leave him alone if he gets things that belong to his classmates. And the reason that she is able to cast the spell on them is because he goes and steals their name tags from school and gives them to his aunt and, you know, ends up being complicit in 17 of his classmates being bewitched and stuck in his family's basement. And as the movie implies, never really quite okay again, even though they are eventually recovered. And it's an interesting move to make a child both this deeply sympathetic and also, you know, responsible on some level for the terrible thing that happens in the center of the movie. And this is not, you know, we need to talk about Kevin. Like, this kid is absolutely a victim of the sort of meta crime that happens to him.
The most sympathetic character in the movie.
Yes, 100%. But at the same time, also someone who, you know, who doesn't ask for help, who does participate in this really ugly wrongdoing against his schoolmates. And that queasiness, I think, is one of the most interesting things in the movie. And the second thing, you know, the second sort of level of ambiguity is, you know, you have this very funny conclusion where Alex manages to turn Gladys's magic against her, sends the kids sort of after her, you know, sort of actually weaponizes them in the way that's been sort of a metaphor in the movie, sends them after Gladys and they tear her to pieces. And while the kids are recovered, the movie is quite clear that they are not okay again. The voiceover returns at the end. You know, some of them are even starting to talk again. And you see, you know, Matthew Archer's son kind of vacant in his dad's arms. And the movie kind of refuses to give you a catharsis, right? Like, the witch is dead. The children get out of the gingerbread house. But on some level, they never really come home. And that combination of something that is very sort of violent and funny, but that also, but where the movie really does underscore that, like, things are not actually okay. Like, you've had your catharsis, but that doesn't mean that things are all right. I think is part of what makes it so effective in the end. I think it's an interestingly potent argument about child abuse, right? I mean, Justine, who's the teacher, and I think Julia Garner's really good in this, is seen kind of repeatedly bugging her boss, or the school's principal, to sort of do more, to look into Alex more. And the principal, Marcus, is very sort of cognizant of not kind of weaponizing his authority. Yes, he's a mandated reporter, but he's not, you know, he is not eager to intervene, right? He is kind of doing his minimum obligation. And to the extent that this movie does have a political valence, it is pushing back on the idea that has, you know, become quite widespread in some circles, that suggests that sort of the child welfare system does more harm than good. Obviously this is a case where if CPS had showed up at Gladys's house, they would have ended up like enchanted in a basement. Their power would have been limited. And in fact, we do, you know, there is a section in the movie where you have a police officer, you have an authority figure at Alex's house who ends up being completely unable to do anything.
Although beforehand, the police did go check the house. And we see this in one of the sort of late movie flashbacks. The police did go check the house, and an interview was arranged with the police to make it seem sort of normal. I actually think this is like one of the weakest, like kind of plot points. Like, they needed to get through that, like, in order to have the rest of the movie happen. And so we get this little bit. It's not like movie destroying or anything, but it is this little bit of like, really? The police just sort of, on the other hand, it goes to the point that the movie is making, I think that Sonny put well, which is that wherever you look thematically in this film, you see that adults are either using children for their own ends or ignoring them.
I think it is very interesting. We were talking about sort of an analysis of the movie and the extent to which that it's about adults weaponizing children. It's very interesting that the, you know, gay married principal is sort of the one person who doesn't use kids for his own ends or agenda in the movie. It sort of cuts against the idea of educators using kids for their own ends, subjecting them to their own agendas, undermining sort of parental authority. If anything, parental authority is sort of, or familial authority is given somewhat too much weight in this movie. I thought that was just sort of an interesting side bit.
Yeah. There is kind of an interesting congruence between this and Barbarians too, which is the uselessness of police. Like, this is there's a sequence in Barbarians where a woman who is being held prisoner escapes from the house, and she runs out and gets the police, and the police dismiss her as like a junkie who needs to sleep it off. Like, that it is the kind of general uselessness of the police figures is, again, kind of an interesting theme here. Alyssa, one last thing before we get to you, Peter. Did you find it interesting that Alex is shown to be a bullied child in this movie?
Yeah.
On several occasions, he is like very clearly being bullied by his classmates, including by Matthew, who is Archer, Josh Brolin's son.
Yeah, and I think that plays into the sort of complicity question in an interesting way, right? It's, and one of the things that is fascinating about the overlap of sort of like that and the school shooting narrative is that there was, you know, if you go back to the Columbine shootings, there was sort of an early narrative that the perpetrators there were bullied. In fact, like, subsequent reporting suggests that they, at least one of them, was actually kind of a bully. But the movie definitely doesn't treat that as like exculpatory, right? You know, it's just one of the things that's kind of in the atmosphere, in a way that,
For the record, I don't think we're supposed to treat Alex as a villain or a perpetrator, really. I think he is, like I said, he is the most sympathetic character in the movie. Yeah. And it was like, I saw it in a relatively crowded Thursday night, opening night theater. And there was a group of women behind me who I found out afterward were school teachers themselves, who, like, every time he was on the screen would go, "Aw, no, yeah, don't be mean to poor Alex." Like, it was right. Like, it was wild.
Right. I mean, he's not a perpetrator, but he is complicit on some level.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And no. I mean, that's a sort of interesting in between space that the movie kind of rests in.
Yeah. Peter, what did you make of Weapons?
I loved it. It's one of my favorite movies of the year. And I think really shows Zach Cregger is just a force to be reckoned with as a director. We were talking before the podcast on text about how David Fincher apparently did some consulting on this movie. Cregger has said, you know, he's thanked him in the credits and said he was quite available during the editing process just to kind of show him technical stuff in particular, just to talk about like image stabilization and sort of rebuilding things in post in a way that Cregger hadn't really seen as possible. And Fincher would walk him through because he was like, well, you know, I was of the opinion, this is the best that I've got. And Fincher's always of the opinion, you can make this better, because Fincher is notably a kind of insane perfectionist. A guy who does 50 takes is his sort of short, like, right, like 50 and 100 is totally possible. My favorite David Fincher bit, like, that I've ever seen is Alien, is in Alien 3.
Yes, yes, right? We've talked about this before.
We know
you love
times.
David Fincher.
I love
not a
him.
David Fincher movie.
But it is. And that's the point that I'm making here. This movie looks in many ways, like even before Fincher came in the post, this movie borrows a bunch of stuff. I shouldn't say borrows, but like clearly sort of pays homage to Gone Girl in particular, and a bunch of kind of Fincherian tricks in the way that the camera moves around, the way the lighting happens, right? But also in Fincher's sly sense of humor. Like, people think of David Fincher as this extremely dark and grimy and grim, you know, sort of purveyor of just like depression, whatever stuff. Like, there's some truth to that. There's definitely some truth. His movies are pretty depressing. Like, Seven is not a movie that is like a great, you know, happy vision of the world. But his movies are also funny. His movies are funny. And I mean, Fight Club in particular, very funny. But there's all these little bits in like Zodiac even that are just kind of like funny little bits of comedy. This was true in the Hitman movie that we watched that I've now just completely lost the name of with
The Killer,
right? Right, just funny little bits. Like, the movie is kind of poking fun of itself or sort of having these like juxtapositions of kind of ironic, a kind of ironic distance where the characters themselves do not see into their own hearts, but you can see that there is, at least you might not even be able to see fully. It's a little opaque, but you can see that there is something amiss, and you see that all over Weapons. You see Weapons is constantly showing us people who seem basically decent, but very flawed, and also not so unself-aware that they are just completely oblivious, but also kind of subtly and importantly not able to see themselves fully. And this is a real, like, a difficult thing to pull off in any movie, but especially in what is essentially like a sort of thriller horror film that is like a suspense movie that is not just like, you know, some sort of like extended character study. And so you're getting these characters who are these fully fleshed out, interesting people, none of whom are heroes, but none of whom are, well, we do have a villain in Aunt Gladys, right? But like, outside of the Aunt Gladys character, no one is just like straightforwardly, this person is a bad person because they're a bad person, they make bad choices. No, these are all people who have made, to some degree or another, some bad choices, but they're trying not to. And they don't always think of themselves as making bad choices. And even when they're in the midst of making a bad choice, you can kind of see, look, yeah, okay, that's an irresponsible amount of drinking that you are doing, or you're drinking in a way that is designed to, like, that is going to lead to irresponsibility, right? Julia Garner's character is like, we see her any number of times going into a liquor store to pick up two bottles of vodka. The two bottle of vodka run to a liquor store by yourself after like you've been through something traumatic, that's always a bad idea. Always a bad idea. Vodka is also terrible. But you see, like you, but at the same time, you can totally imagine here is a person who has been completely cut off from any kind of social support system in her town. She has gone through something totally bizarre and traumatic, and she's self-medicating in a way that is like not advisable, but okay, people can get through that. Also, this is not like the worst possible thing you could do in the world. And this movie is just full of that kind of, I mean, this is not even the best example, but that kind of nuanced and twisty and sort of difficult to decipher. I wouldn't say difficult to decipher. Maybe that's, I did say that, but like, it's not difficult in the sense of
it's
of
open
like you
to
can't,
interpretation.
Yes. It's open to interpretation, and you can you can see multiple sides of things all throughout the movie. And that's a very tricky thing to pull off, especially in the context of an absolutely gripping and suspenseful film. And just to go back one more time to the Fincherian aspect of the, like the kind of as a technical accomplishment, as a piece of cinematic craftsmanship, this is a movie that just constantly had me like getting chills and like kind of thrilled at the camera work, at some of the shot patterns that you see. And there's this incredible, like little tiny, not all that showy chase sequence in the middle of the movie in which Alden Ehrenreich's cop is chasing a homeless drug addict through town. And then you see it again a second time, and it's like even more interesting the second time. But you get this great POV from the cop car, right? Like just these very, very difficult shots to pull off. And then we talked about the night shooting in this movie. The darkness levels in this film are so exquisitely calibrated. And it's just so difficult to pull off good low light night shooting, not just kind of like dim, not like we saw, you know, in Eddington, a movie that looks good, right? To be clear, very good looking movie. But quite dark, where it's like the movie holds you in that space that you have where your eyes, where if you get up in the middle of the night and there's no lights on and there's no street lights on, and your eyes have just barely adjusted enough that it's no longer pitch black and you can start to see, but they haven't fully grasped, you know, gotten into the point where you can see via the moonlight. And so things seem shadowy and murky in a way to your eyes that like is like this movie gets that. It gets it right. It makes your house scarier if you wake up in the middle of the night like that. And this movie gets at the kind of the fear that comes from not quite being able to see, but also being able to see these incredibly tiny shifts in the light. And it's just a great, it's a great bit of cinematic craftsmanship. Works like gangbusters, holds your attention, and does all of these. And does all of this while also having a kind of interestingly opaque and open to interpretability kind of thematic stuff, and not in any way signaling where it's going. And this is the thing that I think I like most about what Kreger is doing here with this movie and Barbarian, is he is absolutely avoiding, both on a thematic and a narrative level, the kind of we don't trust the audience trap of every single beat that this movie is going to give you is basically signposted in the first 5 or 25 minutes. And it's so uncommon now. It's so rare to not see theme is stated. Here's your villain moment. Like, this movie has a very strict three act structure, to be clear, but this is not a movie that uses that structure to kind of check in and be like, here's what's happened, here's what it means, and here's what you're going to get next, because it's this kind of movie and you can totally expect that Baron Zemo is going to show up in the third act because he's here for 10 seconds, right? We dropped his name or whatever the hell, right? Like, it's just, the movie just doesn't do that. You cannot, if you have not seen this movie, not read anything about it, and you watch the first 20 minutes, you will not know where this is going. And yet it doesn't feel contrived. Very difficult challenge.
Yeah. One thing I said about this movie and also about Barbarian is that I really like Kreger's work because he is making movies that are reminders that things can just happen in a movie. And there has to be an internal logic to the film, and it has to make sense within the movie itself. But things can, you are working in fiction. You are not a slave to reality. Things can just happen. Things can be weird and they can go in unexpected directions, and you do not have to hew to, again, like, I feel like we have gotten kind of obsessed with reality, like the movies need to be real. They need to feel real. And that is very much not what Kreger is up to, which I think, again, is refreshing in a way that is unusual.
Right. And it's I think there's something almost, you know, we've talked about the humor of this movie. And I think there's actually something funny about the fact that, you know, this sort of subtle, the subtle mind would not assume that there's actually like a witch who sort of eats children in a movie like this, right? Like that would be the too obvious play. And then the fact that the villain is like actually a witch who sort of eats the life essence of children is funny in a way, right? You know, it comes back to the sort of, you know, it's almost so obvious it's stupid, but then it's brilliant because you dismiss the fact that something this obvious could be where this movie is going.
And look, yeah. There is a hint. There is a hint when Julia Garner's teacher character gets the word witch written on her car very early on. And so this movie is like very subtly pointing you in the direction of what it's going to do. This is a movie in which there's going to be a witch. It's not her, but.
Yeah, I actually hadn't thought about this movie as a witch hunt movie, which the last really good one of those was The Witch, of course, Robert Eggers' The Witch. But I remember people getting very mad about that film as well. There's a slow burn contingent of people who are like really annoyed that so many folks like Weapons. I'm not really interested in them, but there was a similar kind of thing going on with The Witch, the Robert Eggers movie, where people got mad that there was an actual witch in a witch hunt story, because as we all know from Arthur Miller, witch hunts are metaphors that you can only use to deploy against innocent people. But sometimes there are witches. Sometimes witches aren't necessarily real, but bad people are real and they need to be hunted. Just throwing that out there.
There's that meme and it's like witch hunt, but it's spelled witch as in which one. And it's like Helen Hunt or some other people in it, like Al Hunt. Right? Just like witch hunt.
I don't know what you're talking about, but that sounds funny. It sounds like a real thing that's funny. Because witches are real. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Weapons? Peter.
Thumbs up. One of the best movies I've seen this year.
Alyssa.
Thumbs up.
Thumbs up. Three thumbs up for Weapons. I feel like Peter, you had very briefly mentioned this movie being kind of a COVID possible parable, you know, kids. Yeah. And I do think we are. I don't really read it that way, but I think it could be read that way. And I do think we are kind of in between this and Eddington and Cloud, which is a Japanese movie we won't discuss on this show. We are in a very interesting moment for kind of like weird movies about the ways in which society is atomized and having trouble coming back together. And I don't know what it means except for the fact that society is in fact atomized and is having trouble coming back together.
I mean, just very briefly, like what happened to them happened through the schooling system to some degree, in the sense that the kids who were affected by the disappearance were all in the same classroom. So there is a school vector, let's say, for the terrible thing that happened to them. Then society is just baffled for a long time, right? There's this long period of time in this movie where people just don't know what happened to the kids. And in fact, to the extent we have a theme is stated moment, it's when Josh Brolin's character stands up at the town hall and says something to the effect of, I don't know what happened. I can't accept that there is a mystery, right? That we can't know, right? I'm butchering the line, but it is this just fatherly, but also intense frustration, despair, and anger at the fact that not just that the kids are gone, but no one knows what happened, that it is not, that it seems at that point not knowable. And the movie does this great job of not letting you know, oh, it's a witch. It's a crazy witch, right? And then when they do get the kids back, you find the kids again. And Josh Brolin, the final scene in the movie is him hugging his kid. And as Alyssa noted, the kid is not okay. The kid is, and some of the kids, that what we are told is none of these kids ever fully recover. Some of them start talking again. And the opening monologue in the movie, the opening voiceover is about how the police never solved it, right? The authorities who were in charge never actually never actually got their act together to do the thing, to know what happened, right, to figure this out. And look, I don't want to say this is a COVID movie in a direct, like, it's not obviously just a COVID movie, but it is a movie that seems to reflect and refract some of the anxieties around children and what children have gone through with COVID in particular, specifically, and then, but just in the past several years in the COVID era.
It is a movie about, again, how older generations have failed younger generations. And Indeed. One vector through which that failure has manifested is the period of schooling from 2020 to 2022 or so. We'll leave it at that. All right. That is it for this week's. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Dante DiCicco. Tell your friends, a strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If you don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SonnyMunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Thursday.